From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, life in the NFL, we talk with Tim Green, defensive end for the Atlanta Falcons. He's also a newspaper columnist, NPR commentator, law student, and now a novelist. Also today, back on the trail with C.W. Chagru, the boozing, coked-up private eye created by Montana-based writer James Crumley. Crumley's written his first new novel in 10 years. Critic Ken Tucker reviews In Pieces, the new album from country music superstar Garth Brooks. And Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album by British soprano saxophonist Evan Parker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The release of the American pilot captured in Somalia has changed the climate on Capitol Hill, where senators are considering calling on the president to withdraw U.S. forces from Somalia sooner than his March 31st deadline. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
Backers of a quick withdrawal from Somalia say their cause has been given a boost by the release of Army pilot Michael Durant. Now they say the argument that U.S. troops should not leave while U.S. hostages are being held is moot. Senate leaders from both parties are still trying to broker a compromise with West Virginia Democrat Robert Byrd, who wants U.S. forces out of Somalia by February 1st. The chairman of the Armed Services Committee, Democrat Sam Nunn of Georgia, says he would prefer a measure with no deadline in it.
The bottom line for me is having a definitive mission that is clear as to what we would do and what the mission is and what the mission is not.
Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell says he hopes to have an agreement and a vote on the matter later today. This is Brian Naylor at the Capitol.
Haiti's justice minister was murdered today in a drive-by shooting in Port-au-Prince. Local news reports said that Guy Mallory was gunned down along with two bodyguards and a driver. Mallory was part of the transitional government installed early last month to prepare for the return of ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. The killing took place shortly after a UN police contingent of about 50 Canadian Mounties left Haiti until the country's military rulers guarantee to abide by the UN-sponsored agreement. The Mounties were sent to Haiti as part of a plan to retrain Haiti's repressive police force. A Los Angeles judge has denied a defense request to remove a juror in the Reginald Denny beating trial. The jury's been thrown into turmoil this week as two jurors were replaced in the middle of deliberations. From the Los Angeles County Criminal Courthouse, NPR's Renee Montaigne reports.
Defense lawyers in this racially charged case had moved to oust the anonymous juror, a young white woman known as 104, after an older black juror, number 373, was replaced by an alternate. The judge bowed to the demands of the other 11 jurors who said 373 was incapable of understanding what was going on in deliberations. Defense lawyers insisted that there was no evidence that 373 was incapable. Then they proceeded to move to remove juror 104. Based, they said, on the same standard of incompetence, juror 104 was unfit because she had what the defense characterized as a nervous breakdown after she was sequestered. In rejecting the motion, Superior Court Judge Otterkirk said, of the two jurors, the factual circumstances are worlds apart. The defense has now moved for a mistrial. At the Los Angeles County Criminal Courthouse, this is Renee Montaigne.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 18 points to close at 3,621.6. This is NPR News. Polish President Lech Wałęsa has named the head of the leftist Peasants' Party as prime minister. Waldemar Pawlak was nominated by a coalition of his party and the Democratic Left Alliance after they managed to form a majority in the lower chamber of Poland's parliament. The coalition pledged to continue free market economic reforms, but also promised to restore social security protections for the people hit hardest by Poland's transition to capitalism. Israeli and Palestinian negotiators have agreed on an agenda for the talks on an Israeli withdrawal from the Gaza Strip and Jericho. The first round of talks ended today in the Egyptian Red Sea resort of Taba. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
The delegations agreed to set up a subcommittee to deal with the release of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, one of the top priority issues for the Palestinians. Both sides said the atmosphere at the talks was extremely positive, with Israel's Deputy Chief of Staff Amnon Shahak and PLO advisor Nabil Shaath calling each other by their first names. The talks on Israel's withdrawal from Gaza and Jericho are supposed to work out all the details in 2 months and will start again next week. Israel today announced it will allocate $5 million for the security of Jewish settlements in the Gaza and Jericho areas. Even after an Israeli withdrawal, scheduled to be completed in 6 months, Israel says it will remain responsible for the security of Jewish settlers. I'm Linda Gradstein on the Egyptian-Israeli border.
Argentine President Carlos Menem was rushed to the hospital today for emergency heart surgery. The 63-year-old president was apparently stricken as he was on his way to the airport to attend a Latin American summit meeting in Chile. Menem is in the last half of a six-year term, during which he's tried to bring free market reforms to the Argentine economy. He's been pushing for a constitutional change that would allow him to run for a second term. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Tim Green has the athletic power to be a defensive end with the Atlanta Falcons, and he has the literary gifts to write about the NFL for a newspaper column and for NPR's Morning Edition. Now he has a new football novel called Ruffians about the pressures on players to pump up their power with the help of steroids. Green has played with the Falcons since he was a first-round draft pick in 86. He's a graduate of Syracuse University, where he was an All-American defensive end and co-valedictorian of his class. For the past few years, he's been going to law school at Syracuse in the off-season. In his new novel, Ruffians, the team has a program with a secret ingredient, drugs. Green made up the drug in the novel, but he says it combines the qualities of the steroids and amphetamines that many players use.
The steroid part of the drug is a muscle builder, and it makes you bigger, faster, and stronger, all the elements that you'd like to have as a football player. The amphetamine element is, you know, everyone knows what amphetamines do, and, you know, that gives you a lift. So we know, I mean, this is no revelation. We know from the stories of Lyle Alzado and Steve Corson that players use steroids, and we know that they use amphetamines. So I, for the sake of convenience, I combined the two in this kind of wonder drug. And then the third element that I gave the drug was a masking agent. And we also know that those exist and that they can beat the current NFL testing procedure.
There's side effects to the drug that you've created, including shrinking testicles, acne on the upper back, and hair thinning on the back of the scalp. Are those typical side effects of steroids?
Right. Those are the symptoms that people experience when they use steroids. And there are also long-term side effects like liver disorders and pancreatic disorders, kidney disorders that are even more insidious than the short-term effects.
Now, in your novel, the character is approached by the captain of the team and by the doctor on the team, basically told that this is part of the program, you take this drug, which he refuses to do. Have you ever been approached in an official way to do steroids?
Not in an official way, although I've had teammates recommend throughout my years at different levels that I use the drug, that it would be greatly beneficial to me. And I've had it suggested indirectly to me when at different times coaches would say that it would be very beneficial for me if I were to gain 25 or 30 pounds suddenly over a summer. And
is that code?
I think so, yes. And I think that the pressures just from society in general are probably the greatest ones. And just as pressing as the pressures from people surrounding you, because we know that if you use these drugs as an athlete, they will greatly increase your chances for success.
So why have you said no? Especially earlier on when maybe you weren't as aware as you are now of the side effects.
I just always felt that it was important to do things the right way, and that ultimately, if you made the right choices and you followed the rules, that you would ultimately prevail. And I think that's one of the biggest messages I want to get across in Ruffians, and that's that if you do compromise your integrity in any area of your life, somewhere down the line, you'll have to pay a price for that compromise. And I really believe that.
I think your main character says to the team doctor who wants him to take the steroids, he says, well, but steroids aren't good for you. And the doctor says, well, neither is the game of football. Have you heard steroids rationalized that way?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, there's a statistic floating around the league, and I don't know how valid it is, but a lot of players say that the average life expectancy for an NFL player is 55. So it's very easy to rationalize then, if I'm only going to live until 55, what am I worried about liver cancer or kidney disorders at the age of 63? I'll never make it there. And I think that that attitude is very pervasive throughout American sports, especially, well, I say especially in the professional level, but really I think it goes right down to colleges and all the way to high school athletes. I think athletes have this sense of immortality and this sense of living for the moment, and I really tried to capture that in the character of Max. I think Max really typifies the attitude of many athletes.
Max is the character who does steroids in your book. How old are you now?
I'm 29.
And how old is that in football years?
Well, this is my eighth year in the league, and the average lifespan of an NFL player is, I shouldn't say the lifespan, but the average career of an NFL player is 3.5 years. So I've already, you know, gone over twice that life expectancy in the league. So I'm old.
Are you considered a real oldster on the team?
Well, there are a few guys that are older than me, and they're really considered ancient, but I am certainly one of the older players.
How does your body feel differently now during the season than it used to when you were in your early 20s?
Well, things just add up physically. You know, I've got two elbows that are bad, and I've got a knee that's not real good, and my feet are pretty bad, and I've got one shoulder that was separated in college, and on my other side of my body, a separated collarbone. And, you know, injuries like that sometimes just never heal, and they become chronic problems. So the longer you go, the more these things build up, and, you know, you just have to live with it.
In one of your columns, you wrote that by 14 weeks into a season, the older guys slow down and have a code that they'll take it easy on each other, and that this used to appall you as a rookie. How do you feel about it now?
I look back and I wonder why somebody didn't, wait for me after practice and hit me over the head with a lead pipe, because I do the same thing now as an older veteran. I see rookies who are over-enthusiastic during practice, and, you know, I've actually said to players after practice, listen, you've got to just ease up. I mean, I'm still sore from Sunday's game, and I've got a long season to get through.
How long does it take you to feel decent after a game?
Well, it depends on the game. Some games you can actually feel good within 2 days. Other games, it's happened to me where I haven't recovered from 1 week to the next, you know, and then you just kind of hope you can get through until you get a bye week and get, you know, 5 or 6 days off and really rest up. And, you know, you take your anti-inflammatories and those help out a lot. And there's other things you can do, you know, ice and hot whirlpools and things like that.
There's a scene in your novel where the character gets injured, and he hears a pop and sees a flash of light, and he knows he's been hurt pretty seriously. Is that what it's like when you're hurt in a tackle?
Yeah, that's my experience. Whenever I've broken a bone or torn ligaments, that's exactly how I've experienced it. I mean, it's something that you sense in your mind more than anything else. There's a bolt of pain, but the pain isn't really overwhelming. I think the body kind of instantly takes over and with shock and numbs up whatever area is hurt. But it's an incredible sensation. It kind of cuts right to the right to the marrow of your bone, and it's, and you kind of it's an experience that I guess if you haven't had it, you can never really relate it. But for me, the white light and the shock of it is what stands out.
Have you ever had to be taken off the field on a stretcher?
Oh yeah,
what,
sure.
What does it feel like, you know, to be incapacitated in front of an audience of thousands in the stadium and maybe millions at home?
It's a very helpless feeling. You know, I mean, here you are, and you look at yourself as an invincible, strong athlete, and all of a sudden you're reduced to being carted off on a stretcher with a set of wheels by a couple of trainers, and it's in many ways a degrading experience.
I've never played football, and this might sound like a dumb question to anybody who has, but what gets you back into the game after you've been carried out on a stretcher?
Well, that's a good question. I think just a love for the game, a love for the sport and the competition. I mean, really, the game of football is the ultimate athletic challenge, I think, because it combines speed and strength and skill, endurance, and mental and physical toughness. So it's an incredible challenge for any athlete to go out there and play. And because it is such a challenge, there's a real thrill that goes along with it. And at this point in time in my life, I mean, I am a football player, so it's in my blood now, and it's something that I do. You know full well that you're going to get injured in this game. No one goes through the game for 8 years, as I have at this level, without getting any kind of injury. So when it happens to you, you just accept it and you rehab it and you get yourself back into it. And you really don't think about it. You can't think about injury in this game. If you do, you're even more apt to get hurt because you'll be tentative and hesitant, and you might, you know, duck your head or not move your feet when you should. You just have to cut loose and let it go when you're out there.
Are there ways to tackle a person where you know that you're more likely to hurt them, and ways to tackle them where you're being more fair with them?
Absolutely. If you tackle someone with your head down, you're very apt to break their bones or, you know, knock them unconscious. And even more frightening to me is the fact that you're very apt to break your own neck. And, you know, we've seen that obviously result in paralysis, which is kind of the nightmare of every football player, probably every athlete.
One other question along these lines. Have you ever hurt somebody?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've hurt people before.
How does that feel when that happens? How serious have the injuries been, and what was your reaction to it?
Well, there's really a fine line in the game of football, because a lot of your intention is to physically hurt the other player. I mean, you want to, especially as a defensive lineman, which is what I am, you want to punish the offensive lineman in front of you. You want to try to physically intimidate him, and you want to punish the running back and hit him so hard that he'll hesitate the next time he comes through the hole. I mean, that's really part of the game. The fine line comes in that you never want to hurt somebody. I mean, I've knocked people unconscious or separated people's shoulders, and whenever something like that happens, you're very fearful that you've done permanent damage to someone, because that's not part of the game, at least for me. I mean, and I would never want to do that to someone.
Do you feel a certain responsibility to somebody if they've been injured, you know, send them cards or visit them in the hospital, or do you just kind of go on and it's part of the game?
No, you go on and it's part of the game, because you can't think about that. You can't become overly concerned. I mean, if you're out there, you're playing hard, you're hitting people with clean shots and that are all part of the game, you know, people are going to get hurt, and they have to expect it. You have to expect it, and really nobody in this game makes a big deal about it.
My guest is Tim Green. He's a defensive end with the Atlanta Falcons, and he's written a new football novel called Ruffians. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is football player and writer Tim Green.
You went to college in Syracuse, and I believe you were the valedictorian of your class.
Right, I was, yes.
And an All-American.
Right.
An unusual combination outside of made-for-TV movies, right?
Yeah, sometimes truth is stranger than fiction.
So did everybody think of you as being quite unusual for being both?
Yes. My teammates thought I was unusual, and then the people that I associated with around the university and the more intellectual circles thought I was unusual as well.
How did you have time to do both, to do all the studying and all the practicing and playing of games?
Well, I've always tried to make the most of every minute in the day, and I've always structured my time, and it's not that I didn't have a lot of fun in college, because I certainly did, and I did all the normal things that everyone does, but I've always been very careful to use my time as wisely as I could.
So do you take books with you on the road more so than your teammates do?
Oh, absolutely. Even to this day, I take books on the road. It's the constant source of needling from coaches to players to equipment managers about how I've always got my nose in one book or another, or how I'm working on my notebook computer on the plane or in the hotel.
You're in law school now, right?
Right.
And that's what, off-season you do the law school?
Yes, I go to school in the spring semester as a full-time law student.
So how long is it going to take you like that?
Well, I'll finish this May, and it seemed like forever, but it will have taken 6 years in all.
Do you know what kind of law you're going to specialize in?
No, I'm not for sure right now.
Is there athletic law that you're interested in? Sports
no,
law?
No, not really. I mean, if I have one area of interest right now, it's probably estate planning, because I think it's something that I could help people with, and it's not very nasty or controversial.
Is it unusual for a player in the NFL to go to college in the off season?
Well, it's certainly the exception.
Grad
rather
school,
than
I should say,
rule.
Law school, yeah.
Yeah, it's certainly the exception rather than the rule, but there are other players who are in graduate school, and there are other players who are in law school, and there's even a couple guys in the league who are attorneys. There's a defensive lineman in Kansas City and an offensive lineman, Bart Oates, with the New York Giants, who are both members of the bar in their respective states.
As a writer, do you ever wonder why baseball is considered the great literary sport and football is not?
No, I think that the reason is because baseball is a much more subtle sport, and there's a lot more time between the action to dramatize what's going on and to think about things and contemplate the skill of the game and the athletic feats, whereas football is really a much more visceral experience, playing it and watching it.
Tim Green's new novel is called Ruffians. Garth Brooks has a new album. To give you some idea of just how popular this country singer is these days, his album In Pieces debuted on the record charts recently at number one. That's not unusual for a big star, but Brooks's volume of sales is. The number two record that week was Mariah Carey's Music Box, and it sold 175,000 copies. Brooks's album, however, sold over 400,000, a huge disparity. Why is Garth Brooks country music's biggest star? Rock critic Ken Tucker has some hunches, along with a review.
I spent last night in the arms of a girl in Louisiana. And though I'm out on the highway, my thoughts are still with her. Such a strange combination of a woman and a child. Such a strange situation, stopping every 100 miles, calling Baton Rouge.
I've boiled it down to two lists. First, here's what I like about Garth Brooks. One, he's an overreacher who wants to transcend his country label to be a truly popular artist. Two, he writes about sex a lot more than any other country performer who actually has hits. Three, he likes rock and roll and doesn't care who knows it. even if the rock and roll he likes includes Billy Joel, Kiss, and Bob Dylan's subterranean homesick blues ripoffs like this.
6 o'clock on Friday evening, mama doesn't know she's leaving. Did she hear the screen door slamming, rubber squealing, gears are jamming. Local country station just a blaring on a radio. Pick him up at 7 and they're heading to the rodeo. Mama's on the front porch screaming out her warning. Girl, you better get your red head back in bed before the morning. Clock show is in, but the fun is just beginning. She knows he's anticipating, but she's gonna keep him waiting. Grab a bite to eat, and then they're heading to the honky tonk. But loud crowds and line dancing just ain't what they really want. Drive out to the boondocks and park down by the creek, hey, where it's George Strait real late and dancing cheek to cheek. Ain't going down till the sun comes up. Ain't giving in till they get enough. Go around the world in a pickup truck.
Now, here's what I don't like about Garth Brooks. One, his capacity for schmaltz is second only to that of Neil Diamond. Two, in concert, he uses those smoke bombs that explode loudly and cover the stage with fog. Three, my favorite song on this new album also contains his most repellent lyric, a gratuitous swipe at people on welfare in an otherwise terrific honky-tonk song. I hate it when artists make my pleasure ambivalent.
If your paycheck depends on the weather and the clock, if your conversation calls for a little more than a coffee pot, if you need to pour your heart out and try to rectify some situation that you're facing, contact your American Honky Tonk Bar Association. Uncle Sam dips in your pocket for most things you don't mind, but when your dollar goes to all of those standing in a welfare line, we'll rejoice you have a voice if you're concerned about the destination of this great nation. It's called the American Honky Tonk Bar Association. Since the hard hat, gun rack, aching back, overtaxed, flag waving, fun loving crowd, their heart is in the music and they love to play it aloud. There's no forms or no applications, there's no red tape administrations. It's the American Honky Tonk Bar Association.
From a technical standpoint, In Pieces is Brooks' best album. The music is varied, spare, and firm. His vocals are very sly and expressive. He's using that gulping catch in his voice to convey everything from horniness to hopelessness. But that line about welfare cheats doesn't square with the song he included on his last album, We Shall Be Free, which preached tolerance for everyone in terms far more specific than a conservative genre like country music ever gets. With the sales figures he's got, Garth Brooks is obviously many things to many people. I just wish that one of the things he wasn't to me is a shameless opportunist.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
One night a day, one step away from leaving. Sit up with the radio, sing along with the ones I know, to get through one night a day.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, a writer who likes to hang out at bars and created a private eye that owns one. We'll talk with James Crumley, the Montana-based detective writer. He's written his first new novel in 10 years. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new album by the British soprano saxophonist Evan Parker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton stressed this morning that no deals were cut with factional leader General Adid in Somalia in order to gain the release of U.S. pilot Michael Durant. Mr. Clinton also said that he would be more cautious in the future about putting American troops in a U.N. peacekeeping role when there is any uncertainty about the mission. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The president said Durant's release was one of the hopeful actions that indicates U.S. policy in Somalia is making progress, and he pledged to finish the job. But he emphasized that it's up to the Somalis to reestablish a viable government and only up to the United States to give them the time to do so. Referring to his critics on Capitol Hill, the president said it's easy to second guess.
You had to know when we went there that there was, that A, that there was no way America was going to get out in January, and because there was no political process in place there that could have given the Somalis a chance to survive, and B, that there was every chance that someone, for their own reasons, at some point during this mission, might kill some peacekeepers.
The Senate is expected to consider an amendment to bring U.S. troops home from Somalia earlier than the deadline set by the president. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
In Haiti, gunmen have killed the nation's Minister of Justice along with three other people. According to Haitian radio stations, Justice Minister Guy Mallary was shot to death by gunmen who opened fire on his car. Two of his bodyguards were also killed, along with the driver. A German UN soldier has been shot in Cambodia. He is the first German soldier to be killed on active duty since the Bonn government started taking part last year in UN peacekeeping activities. Deidre Berger has more.
Unknown assailants on a motorcycle opened fire on the 26-year-old army medic and another German soldier as they were driving in Phnom Penh in a UN vehicle. The injured medic was brought immediately to the German-run UN hospital on the outskirts of the city, but doctors were unable to save his life. The German defense minister called the killing tragic. The UN hospital will be closed by the end of the year after the scheduled withdrawal of UN peacekeeping forces in Cambodia. Germany's participation in international peacekeeping troops continues to spark domestic political controversy because the German constitution restricts the armed forces to national defense and to the defense of allied territory. Last week, Defense Minister Volker Rühe stressed Germany's resolve to keep troops in Beledweyne, Somalia, despite growing clashes between UN troops and Somalia gunmen. For National Public Radio, this is Deidre Berger reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 18 points to close at 3,621.63 on volume of 352 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 10 to 9. This is NPR News. Police say that five people have been shot to death at a health club in El Cajon, California. Officials say a lone gunman drove up to a fitness center, shot one person outside the building, and then walked inside where he shot three more people before he committed suicide. At least one other person was injured. Four people, including the gunman, died at the scene. A fifth person died later at a hospital. Scientists say that they have discovered the role that cocaine plays in nature. A report published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences indicates the drug is a natural insecticide. David Barron of member station WBUR reports.
Scientists have long known about the effects cocaine has in people, but they've been unsure why coca plants evolved to produce the chemical. Researchers at Massachusetts General Hospital now say the substance protects the plants from insects. To test the idea, Dr. James Nathanson sprayed small amounts of cocaine on tomato leaves.
Insects placed on these leaves stopped feeding, became very hyperactive, and at higher concentrations of cocaine, the insects were killed within 24 hours.
Nathanson says cocaine interacts with a chemical found in insect brains. He says the drug acts differently in people. The scientists don't recommend that cocaine be sprayed on crops, but they believe the compound could provide clues for producing new pesticides that are safe and effective. For National Public Radio, I'm David Barron in Boston.
The Labor Department says the number of people filing new claims for jobless benefits increased in the latest reporting period. The Labor Department says in the week ending October 9th, new claims were up by some 8,000. This came after a drop in new claims the week before. And the government says that retail sales moved up slightly last month by 0.1%. The Commerce Department says that sales have increased now for 6 months in a row. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Good news for James Crumley fans. He has a new novel, his first in 10 years. It brings back his private eye, C.W. Chagrew, who first appeared in the novel, The Last Good Kiss. Crumley's other two detective novels, The Wrong Case and Dancing Bear, feature the private eye, Milo Dragovich. The Village Voice has called Crumley a first-rate American writer. Harper said what Raymond Chandler did for the Los Angeles of the 30s, James Crumley does for the roadside West of today. Crumley was born in South Texas and now lives in Montana, where much of his fiction is set. Crumley's new novel is called The Mexican Tree Duck. I ask the question that's on the minds of most of his readers, why has it been so long between novels?
Well, I was working in Hollywood writing unproduced screenplays and paying some bills, and you know, I guess I just sort of hadn't found a book that I wanted to work on, nor a book that paid as much money to work on as it did working on screenplays. You know, quite frankly, my books didn't make any money for a long time. I still haven't made a lot of money. And I guess I needed a break. I'm not quite sure. But I was working all through that time. I never found the right material.
What kind of unproduced screenplays had you been writing?
Almost everything. I adapted one of my novels, Dancing Bear, with a director named Tim Hunter.
What happened with that?
Nothing. It's just the script sitting in Warner's vaults.
It must be a very frustrating occupation to write things that end up sitting on somebody's shelf.
Well, it's when I was a younger man, it might have made me, and when I'd done less teaching and when I'd, you know, gone through less years being broke, it might have made me angry. But as it is, it's just part of the job. It's part of the deal. When you go to Hollywood, you accept the fact that you're working for somebody else, unless you're writing strictly originals and directing them yourself. And it is disappointing to get to the end of a job and find you don't have anything at the end but a check. But I don't have any real complaints. I enjoy working in Hollywood and plan to continue.
Your fiction has had two main characters. Some novels have Milo Dragovich mm-hmm. as the main character. And your new novel has your character of C.W. Chagrew.
Chagrew.
Why did you choose Chagrew for the new novel as opposed to Milo?
Well, I got to using the Chagrew voice because United Artists owned the Milo Dragovich character at one time.
Well, you had sold the movie rights to him?
Yes. And so my agent suggested I just change the name, and when I changed the name, I picked up a character out of an unfinished novel, and he had the right kind of history to be a private eye, so I used him, and it changed the novel. And so pretty much now what I do is I write 100 pages without really knowing whose novel it's going to be, and so I let the material tell me which detective to use.
Do you feel closer to either of the two characters? Do you feel like either of them is more like you?
I think Milo's maybe a better version of me. He's a is a kinder and a more. He's the voice that somehow helped me learn how to handle the world, and then the Shagru voice is the voice that helped me learn how to handle Hollywood.
Why did Shagru help you with Hollywood?
Well, he's got no backup in him, and he don't give up, and he don't. He's just a little bit meaner and a little bit less willing to get along.
Well, tell us what brought Shagru to Montana and what brought you to Montana.
Well, I came here to teach freshman comp in 1966 when I finished my MFA at the University of Iowa. And it took leaving once to realize that I'd found a home. I grew up in Texas and never felt very much at home there. And then Shagru came here on a case chasing a guy and ended up staying when the guy killed himself. This is in the opening of the novel, actually. The guy hung himself in the bathroom of a bar, and his wife sicked so many lawyers and lawsuits on Shagru that he finally moved to Montana to get away from it all. And he too found a home in a different kind of way than I did, but a home nonetheless.
He runs a bar.
Well, the private eye business has not been good for him lately. He doesn't do the kind of work that's really lucrative, the industrial stuff and the security stuff. He mostly has one talent, and that's finding people. And so he's now, either he said somewhere or I said somewhere that it seems that either people stopped running away or other people stopped looking for them. And so he's now managing a bar on the outskirts of Meriwether, Montana.
There's a paragraph about bars. Would you read that for us?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
This is from the beginning of The Mexican Tree Duck by James Crumley.
Bars can be nice places, comfortable, homes away from the loneliness or confusion of homes. But nobody, not even the most confirmed, degenerate drunk, can spend 80 or 90 hours a week in one. I went through so much help, I actually hired a woman so drunk she had forgotten that I'd fired her the week before. I don't know what my excuse was. Something to do with my nose, I suspect. As far as I was concerned, sunshine was something that happened in another country. I didn't care if it came out, but then it did, just to prove me wrong.
Have you spent a lot of time in bars?
I've spent a considerable portion of my life in bars.
Do you like bars?
I've always been... I've been the sort of person that's always had a local, as the Brits say, and I'm always, when I'm driving someplace, I tend to stop in bars and find out where I'm going and talk to people. I've done that not just in the States, but also in England and Scotland and France and Mexico and the Philippines. It's as if bars are places where people let their guards down and they're willing to be engaged in a sort of way. They're not willing to be at home or on the sidewalk or in business situations.
When you talk about people letting their guards down in bars, are you talking about other people or yourself too?
Well, I don't know about myself. For years, I wouldn't tell anybody in a bar that I was a writer. I would tell them that that the telephone company had run over my foot, and I'd gotten a big settlement, and I was living off of that. And it was a wonderful way to begin a conversation because, everybody's had trouble with the telephone company in one way or another, and they're always happy to see somebody that's engaged them in one. And so they'd start that, and then you'd get the stories without having to have them turn to you to say, well, you're a writer, huh? Boy, you could make a novel out of my life, which is the worst way to begin a story.
Right. And then you just get a rambling version of the person's life, huh?
Well, you just get the stories in bursts.
If you're just joining us, my guest is James Crumley. He has a new detective novel called The Mexican Tree Duck. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Writer James Crumley is with us. There's a moment in your new novel, The Mexican Tree Dock, in which the main character is thinking back to an incident that really changed his life. He had gone to the National Gallery, and seeing the paintings there led him to stop being as violent. I'm wondering where that incident in the book comes from, if that connects to anything in your life.
Well, that may be the only autobiographical thing I've ever written about. That I wasn't down there playing football. I was just down on a weekend pass and from Fort Devens in Massachusetts. And I'd probably never seen a painting that wasn't on velvet by that time. And so that was a really important moment in my life. I don't know exactly what, and it wasn't about being less violent, because I was never as violent as Chagrou. That was never one of my major difficulties with life. But it did something to me, the kind of thing that it still does. Like, I can go to Paris and stand in the Van Gogh room at the Musée d'Orsay, and it transcends something inside you. There is something about looking at those paintings that just brings a thrill to your heart. Jesus, it's just wonderful.
Since you didn't grow up around art, were you shocked to find the impact it could have on you?
Shocked is not quite the right word. I was just—I was literally amazed. I mean, I wouldn't leave. Everybody else wanted to go out drinking and chasing girls, and I wouldn't leave. And finally, I left when they closed. Yeah, and I had the say-so because I had the car keys. And I just never seen anything like that. If I'd have been a more sophisticated reader, I would have known that something like that was possible, but I wasn't prepared for it. And even though I'm prepared for it now, it's still a shock. But it's okay. It's a good shock.
Your character Chagrou says, maybe that was my life, helping those who could still care, even if I couldn't. Does that condition, that condition of not caring, apply to you at all?
I don't think so. I can remember a period in my life where things were so troubled that it felt as if I had run out of emotions. That I was just, that I was incapable of the kind of feeling that I just couldn't stand it anymore. I think that's a fairly common thing. People just shut down their emotions because they can't deal with them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But that's certainly not been true for a long time. I have 5 children and 5 grandchildren and a new wife and a new house and a wonderful old cat and lots of good friends and lots of political attitudes and there's many things that I care about, I can still cry at movies.
Well, I think of myself as a person who's kind of emotionally involved with things myself, and yet I really relate to lines like that. Maybe mm-hmm. that was my life, helping those who could still care, even if I couldn't. What is it that is appealing about reading about that condition of not caring, even if you're very kind of emotionally entangled things yourself in things yourself?
Jeez, I don't know. A couple of reviewers have picked on that exact line and called it self. What do they call that word?
Self-dramatizing.
Self-indulgent. Self-pitying. And looking at it in retrospect and in the cold heart of a radio studio, maybe there is a certain amount of self-pity. Maybe it's in the fact that you can't always have raging emotions. It's hard to keep that emotional level up all the time, perhaps. And But, you know, the idea that that even if you can't keep it up for yourself, you can keep it up for other people is, you know, it gives you a nice sense of martyrdom or something. I don't know. I just thought it was a nice moment. And, I mean, Chagrou's obviously all the way through this book, he has reached that state where he's not sure anymore. He's lost something, and he's trying to get it back. And I hope in some ways he does get it back by the end. I won't talk about the ending because
it's the ending.
It's the ending, right?
Okay. Well, one last question: are you writing any screenplays that you're certain will go unproduced?
I'm adapting Dancing Bear for Robert Towne now.
Mm-hmm.
And this looks like the closest I've ever gotten to anything.
It must be something to adapt it for him because he's not only a director and screenwriter, but he was known as like the script doctor in Hollywood. If you needed a screenplay that needed fixing, he was one of the guys you take it to.
Yes, he still is. And he's a genius, and it's been a great deal of fun to work for him. And I thought it was wonderful that he thought that I should write this script instead of him. And maybe between the two of us, we'll have a movie sometime next year.
Yeah, wouldn't that be nice?
It sure would.
Well, I hope so. Well, thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me. I sure appreciate it.
James Crumley's new novel is called The Mexican Tree Duck. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have from Somalia?
Hi, Terry. Chief Warrant Officer Michael Durant and a Nigerian peacekeeper have been released in Mogadishu. NPR's Ted Clark reviews the history of U.S. involvement in peacekeeping situations. Kathy Lohr reports on an orphan train reunion coming up this weekend in Missouri. The orphan trains took youngsters from New York City to new lives in the Midwest, often exploiting the youngsters in the process. Also, letters from listeners this evening. It's Thursday. Letters about Somalia, dialectical speech, and is Michael Jordan a folk hero or, indeed, a national hero?
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. That's the English soprano saxophonist Evan Parker. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says he loves Parker's music, even if it seems like Parker's the master of all the saxophone's ugly sounds. Kevin says this music may strike you as strong stuff, but some people didn't like coffee the first time they tried it either.
Evan Parker's alien solo music is rooted in familiar sources, John Coltrane and Scottish bagpipes. Parker imitates the drone of a piper's bellows bag using a technique called circular breathing. This lets you play a wind instrument without pausing to take a breath. The trick is, close your throat and use your cheeks to squeeze air out your mouth while inhaling through your nose. Before Parker found his own voice in the 1960s, John Coltrane was a key role model. In a way, Parker's solo music takes off from one skirling phrase Coltrane favored back then. What Parker does with this one chip of Coltrane is like building dinosaurs from a scrap of DNA. Evan Parker's new solo CD on the label is called Conic Sections. In geometry, conic sections are lines and circles and ellipses, parabolas, and hyperbolas, loops that elongate and fly off on tangents. Thank you. friend of mine says listening to this is like monitoring Evan Parker's brainwaves. You do get the feeling the music moves beyond his conscious control because he's doing more things at once than he can think about. Circular breathing lets him sustain different rhythm patterns in different registers of the saxophone. But each pattern seems to live its own life, so separate lines intersect unpredictably. He might even get two falsetto patterns going at the same time. There's a tactile aspect to Evan Parker's playing which may not come off on radio, a whirring in your outer ear caused by the friction among different high frequencies. After listening to Parker do this stuff for 15 years, I'm amazed he can take a handful of ideas and create something of substance every time. His music can really get to you in a good way. First you hear chaos, then you hear order, then you hear the heart.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz critic living in New York. He reviewed Conic Sections by British saxophonist Evan Parker on the Ah-Um label. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Nancy Greenlease and Peter Clowney. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Devin Reif is our intern. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3393. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, join us for our weekly archives edition, featuring encore broadcasts of some of our most requested interviews. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.